Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 19 and 20, May 9th and 16th, 2011. Guilty verdict stuns. Judge disallows testimony that could have exonerated Patriot lawyer, by Pat Shannon. Looking pale and drawn from 11 months of jailhouse food and no sunlight, Idaho attorney Edgar Steele, 65, was finally able to face his accusers when his federal trial began in Boise on April 27th. He was charged with hiring his handyman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. On May 5th, his jury of 11 women and one man found him guilty on all four counts. Murder for hire, use of interstate commerce for same, possession of a destructive device, and tampering with a victim. The jury had to sort out who plotted against whom. Did Steele want his wife murdered, or did Larry Fairfax, 50, steal the family's silver from his secret hiding place and then fabricate the murder plot as a cover-up? Jailhouse inmate Darrell Hollingsworth testified that Fairfax told him that the FBI had made a deal with him to frame Steele. A crudely constructed pipe bomb was found underneath Cindy's SUV when she stopped for a routine oil change in Coeur d'Alene on June 15th, but the fuse was faulty and had failed to ignite from muffler heat as the culprits apparently expected. Fairfax had admitted last year that he had placed the bomb there 2 weeks earlier. Lending a further shadow of suspicion over authorities was their own court testimony that no fingerprinting of the bomb was attempted before or after removal. The Steeles claimed they were set up because of his politically incorrect stand on various issues. Both Cindy and daughter Kelsey, 20, testified that they have endured telephone death threats for several years. Several FBI audio recordings of Steele played for the jury sounded potentially incriminating, but defense attorneys enlisted the aid of two audio experts who, independently, found the recordings to be contrived. One listed over 300 suspicious discrepancies and went so far as to assert that the voice discussing the murder-for-hire payoffs with Fairfax was not that of Steele. At the April 20th to 21st pre-trial hearings, Judge Lynn Windmill dealt the defense a severe blow by ruling that the recordings could be entered into the case, but not the testimony of the two experts. Dr. George Papkun of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Dennis Walsh, a former New York City detective in charge of audio at the precinct level. Their testimony had the potential to destroy the government's case as well as provoke a fraud investigation, but it was not heard. Unexpected testimony from Fairfax during cross-examination revealed that he was writing a book, but after examining over 250 pages of manuscript, the court determined there were no incriminating admissions or confessions. More details of the case will emerge. Page 2, personal from the editor. AFP, your paper of record. AFP has been sorting through the facts and mysteries surrounding Barack Obama's alleged long-form birth certificate, the attempted assassination of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, and the supposed death of the villain of villains, Osama bin Laden, which deflated the birther issue just as the president's approval ratings were hitting rock bottom. Several items in this edition explore these matters, about which the regular media sing the same tune. President Obama's birth document is 100% grade A genuine, so that means he's Hawaiian-born and case closed. Gaddafi and his family are bad people deserving of death, and as for the other guy, Osama, the rousing chorus is ding dong, the witch is dead, and the tall 9/11 tale we have been told is portrayed as even more credible by the almighty state. A number of 9/11 survivors are upset that bin Laden was given a sea burial since the best evidence of all to identify the deceased, the body, is forever lost. The survivors' view that Americans deserve to see the body was coldly dismissed. Even photos will not be released. We are expected to take this whole thing on faith. And even as Osama's alleged corpse languishes on the bottom of the Arabian Sea, which for all we know is a bag of rocks with a turban and a beard attached, Obama is riding the big but maybe brief wave of credit for slaying global terrorism's premier bogeyman. Over the 10 years since 9/11, AFP has withstood severe criticism for leading the fight among national papers to declare the conventional 9/11 story a fraud. Architect Richard Gage has shown that internal structural demolition of the Twin Towers was apparent. Physicist Stephen Jones found physical evidence of sophisticated internal charges there and told AFP about it. Former Army Specialist April Gallup survived the 9/11 Pentagon blast and maintains there was no plane wreckage. Then there is Victor Thorne's exploration of Flight 93 and the total lack of evidence that it crashed where they said it did in Shanksville, PA on 9/11, as we all were told, along with evidence of Israeli involvement in league with a neoconservative clique that benefited handsomely from the wars supposedly justified by 9/11. AFP, ahead of the curve in these and other areas, also has detailed the police state spawned by these 9/11 lies. Still, DC and the mainstream media insist, despite all of the evidence to the contrary, that the bin Laden myth must survive, even if he is dead, and Obama, Cheney, and others insist the war on terror, which really is a war of terror, will continue unabated, no matter the cost. Mark Anderson. News you may have missed. No security groping allowed in Texas. Enhanced pat-downs carried out by security officers with the Transportation Security Administration could be a criminal matter under a bill gaining momentum in the Texas legislature. The proposed law, aimed at people conducting security checkpoints at airports and public buildings in the state, would make it a felony to intentionally touch someone's private areas, even on top of clothing, unless the officer has probable cause to believe the person is carrying something illegal. State Representative David Simpson, Republican Longview, who sponsored the bill, said invasive pat-down searches are a violation of the Fourth Amendment. More on food stamps. 1 in 7 Americans is now on food stamps, according to the federal government's latest figures. Mortgage fraud revealed. The U.S. government is suing Germany's Deutsche Bank AG, one of the world's top banks, for massive mortgage fraud, according to court filings. Since 1999, a Deutsche Bank subsidiary has been fudging strict federal government rules in order to get U.S. taxpayer backing for 40,000 mortgage loans worth $5 billion that it knew were risky. Since that time, one-third of those mortgages ended up in foreclosure. Congrats for illegal grads. Speaking at the commencement ceremony at Miami-Dade College on April 28th, President Obama pledged to help graduates of the community college who are illegal immigrants become American citizens. "I know that several young people here have recently identified themselves as undocumented," said Obama. "I will keep fighting alongside many of you to make the DREAM Act the law of the land." That refers to the Democratic-backed bill that would give citizenship to children of illegal immigrants who go into the military or have completed 2 years of college. Ludicrous burial antics. We were told the U.S. government had to bury Osama bin Laden within 24 hours because this was required by Islamic law, and the government respected those laws. However, Islamic law forbids sea burial unless death occurred at sea, which is how the Obama regime chose to dispose of the evidence. Osama has died 9 times since September 11, 2001, but there is no evidence he died a 10th time on May 1, 2011. Not-so-friendly fire. Since 2008, 38 NATO soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan by police, soldiers, or security guards who work for the Western-backed Afghan government, reports Stars and Stripes newspaper. Surprisingly, the killers are not usually Taliban sleeper agents or imposters. They often appear to be regular Afghan troops who start shooting after some dispute with coalition troops. Dismissed. In New Haven, Connecticut, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit released its 13-page decision for the April 5th hearing in which it dismissed the appeal of plaintiff April Gallup, a former Army specialist and Pentagon 9/11 survivor. The court may even try to sanction her. The latest on the Barack Obama birth certificate issue. The latest Certificate of Live Birth, CoLB, that Barack Obama issued in late April, which the mainstream hails as the final proof of his birth in Honolulu, is not a real birth certificate at all, and is but a poor imitation of an authentic CoLB. Computer imagery experts have already shown that the letters and numbers were digitally manipulated and superimposed onto a recreation of green document paper using a modern computer, meaning that in these experts' view, the latest CoLB is not an authentic photocopy of an original 1961 record filled out with a 1960s manual typewriter. But wait, there's more. The authenticity of Obama's certificate of live birth is seriously in doubt, but it is by no means the only issue rendering him ineligible to occupy the nation's highest office. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5 of the U.S. Constitution says, "The president must be a natural-born citizen." Many people erroneously think that means merely native-born, but Ohio Representative John Bingham's definition of the term in 1866 on the House floor remains unchallenged. "Every human being born within the United States of parents not owing allegiance to any foreign sovereignty is, in the language of your Constitution itself, a natural-born citizen." That is taken to mean both parents. Every president from George Washington on has qualified under that definition except for Obama, whose supposed father was a Kenyan native and a British subject. And even more. Birthers, as they are called, want to know why Obama's latest Kolb has a serial number several digits higher than two verified Kolbs from a set of twins born 2 days after the president was born. It should be lower, not higher. Page 3, AFP on the police state. Big Brother's True Agenda Revealed in Airport Security by Frank Whalen. As Big Brother struggles to find a rationale for maintaining and expanding its total surveillance society, once again alerts are being raised on air travelers as potential terrorists, while the Transportation Security Administration inspires more outrage through its intrusive pat-down process and its body scan imaging that have caused several scandals. Department of Homeland Security DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano offered a de facto compromise to calm angry and violated flyers who advocate common sense over fear-based protocols. And take note that her statement came before Americans were faced with the heightened alerts that follow the announced death of Osama bin Laden, as intelligence agencies claim America must brace for potential retaliations. What Mrs. Napolitano, who has come to be known as Big Sis, said on April 20th was that DHS is expanding trust in traveler programs, programs where people will get biometric cards. They've already supplied information. We know they are safe to travel. We can move them through the system. That's going to be expanded this year. That allows us to remove a number of people from the screening process. Has Washington's endgame been revealed? If you submit your Social Security number and fingerprints and agree to retinal scans, you won't have to submit to groping or naked scans while traveling through airports. According to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection website, this program known as GOES, or Global Online Enrollment System, requires that every individual who would like to apply for membership, children included and multiple applicants in one household, must create a separate account within GOES, submit a separate application, and schedule a separate interview appointment upon conditional approval. In essence, this is a continuation of ongoing efforts to collect personal data, such as with the National Healthcare ID Program, passports and driver's licenses, Social Security numbers, information gathering by the IRS and the Census Bureau, as well as numerous governmental watch lists. The private sector also seems happy to comply with contributions such as OnStar, LoJack, Google's Wi-Fi hacking and Street View maps, the GPS functionality of smartphones and laptops, as well as the airline's no-fly lists. According to the Global Entry Trusted Traveler Network website, participants at airports will proceed to Global Entry kiosks, present their machine-readable U.S. passport or permanent resident card, place their fingertips on the scanner for fingerprint verification, and make a customs declaration. The kiosk issues each traveler a transaction receipt and directs the traveler to baggage claim in the exit. The website also describes the prerequisites needed to join this program. All applicants undergo a rigorous background check and interview. The process begins with a non-refundable $100 fee, and then upon review, the applicant is instructed to schedule an interview at a Global Entry Enrollment Center within 30 days of conditional approval. In that interview, a U.S. Customs and Border Protection CBP officer will ask you questions, take your photo, and collect biometric information. Moreover, all applicants must voluntarily undergo a thorough background check against criminal, law enforcement, customs, immigration, agriculture, and terrorist indices to include biometric fingerprint checks and a personal interview with a CBP officer. Follow-up interviews may be required, and some law enforcement databases used in the process appear to include Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the FBI, and Drug Enforcement Administration. The site also states, having a criminal record or past violation of CBP laws, regulations, policies may render you ineligible for participation. It's unlikely that this system will do anything more than promise future convenience for a traveler willing to undergo a massively intrusive, unconstitutional process, only to have to do it all over again when the program membership expires. It does, however, bring in a great deal of highly personal data on individuals and presumably a large amount of revenue for government. Page 4, AFP on the police state. Smartphone spying exposed by Jeffrey Smith. In a series of new revelations, researchers have found that personal electronic devices carried by millions of Americans collect and transmit a wide range of sensitive private data on their owners' activities, movements, and associations. This information is promptly delivered to various government agencies and sold to private groups. But in at least one situation, which patriots are calling outrageous, the cell phone data collection would be impossible without the involvement of a key foreign technology. Since 2008, constitutionalists and civil libertarians in Michigan have been protesting the growing practice of the Michigan State Police's downloading of personal data from cell phones during standard traffic stops. The warrantless electronic searches are now possible due to the development of a new device which has the ability to download the content of a cell phone in 90 seconds, including where the cell phone user has been, along with a date and timestamp, a history of calls that has been made and received, emails and deleted emails, as well as photos. The new device, which makes the Michigan and other government agencies' actions possible, is the Cellebrite UFED, designed and manufactured in Israel. In late April, with the storm of media coverage, the one aspect of the story that the mainstream media has avoided was the mention of Israel's involvement in the matter. One popular shortwave and internet conservative radio host very carefully avoided any mention of the Cellebrite's national origins. In recent years, Michigan patriots have wanted to know more about Israel's covert program of personal electronic device surveillance, only to run into a solid wall of silence. Finally, the state branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, in an unrelated action, brought a Freedom of Information request asking for any information on the program which may show how the Cellebrite device is being used. The device, according to the manufacturer's literature, can read 3,000 models of cell phones, bypassing any passwords or firewalls. After over a year of strong resistance, Michigan agreed to share some information on the program, but only if the ACLU or other interested parties could pay the state $544,680 for what they said was the cost to the state of their providing documents on the program. The continuing revelations have prompted several members of Congress to move toward holding hearings in the matter. Early last week, Representative Ed Markey, Democrat, Massachusetts, sent a strongly worded letter to Apple President Steve Jobs asking the extent of the iPhone's collection of users' sensitive data. The letter also probed if Apple had violated a key section of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which prohibits disclosure or access to users' location data without express prior customer authorization. It appears that no one in the telecom industry, various layers of government, or private beneficiaries of phone users' personal data have complied with the law. In further development, several major media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, have revealed that the latest generation of cell phones and other personal electronic devices, especially smartphones, have the ability to keep location data with timestamp for up to a year. Researchers have also found that many major brands of phones have the ability to sense not only the location of the phones, but their proximity to other phones in the area, providing a detailed picture of personal associations, and they can do this even if the phones are turned off. Many researchers note that newer phones prevent the removal of batteries and the memory SIM card, the key identifying devices in phones, or make it nearly impossible to remove them. Thus, a phone may be off, but it is not really deactivated and can continue to spy on its owner's activities and habits. Information is often sold to a wide variety of commercial marketers, advertisers, and in some cases to the academic community for sociological studies. Telecommunications firms say that they strip off names of users before their personal data is sold, but few people actually believe them. Some engineers contend it is possible for phones even with batteries removed to be designed to remain active, collecting information for an unknown period of time. They also warn that removal of the battery and SIM card does not protect against the device containing an RFID chip and coming near one of the thousands of reader stations which have proliferated in cities and even small towns of late. Meanwhile, a number of sources are warning that both government agencies and foreign governments can increasingly pull formerly secure information from cell phones and mobile devices by wireless means, needing only 300 feet proximity to the device. The threat of wireless interrogation of devices has risen to the point that several leading patriotic activists have taken to storing their mobile devices in double-walled, radio-signal-resistant enclosures. Experts warn, however, that while such enclosures offer some protection, they are seldom totally effective. Observers in the Midwest say there may be a very important reason why Michigan is doing everything not to answer simple questions on these apparent activities, given that the device which makes the program possible is an Israeli product with strong intelligence-gathering potential. The device had to be approved or at least come to the notice of layers of intelligence agencies before its importation. There is also the question of who trained the Michigan State Police and other government agencies involved in the device's use. Page 6. Machinations of the Global Elite. Goals of Globalists Revealed at Recent Policy Meetings, by James P. Tucker, Jr. As Bilderberg prepares to gather in St. Moritz, Switzerland on June 9 to 12, they remain determined, despite setbacks, to hurt you in two essential ways. Increase the cost of gasoline in America to more than $7 a gallon, and create a world treasury agency to redistribute your wealth. By forcing the price of gasoline up, Bilderberg, like its brother group, the Trilateral Commission, TC, wants to keep Americans in a recession through 2012 and pressure Congress and the White House into not only maintaining, but increasing foreign aid. This, they reason, will bring down the American standard of living while lifting that of poor nations. The entire world is to have roughly the same standard of living, low. These goals were clearly stated by Henry Kissinger, Joseph Nye Jr., and other internationalists at the recent Trilateral Commission meeting in Washington, and will be restated in Switzerland. Hungry Americans will eagerly accept a World Treasury entity by the end of 2012, both said. Both tried to sound hopeful, although the Bilderberg TC elites have suffered huge setbacks for years. In the 1990s, they were confident there would be an American Union by the year 2000, a superstate similar to the European Union wherein nations surrender their sovereignty. The arrogant EU Parliament imposes laws on member states, though Switzerland has managed to stay out of the EU. The EU court overrules decisions of national courts and imposes its will throughout the continent. But even in greater Europe, there is resistance as public knowledge increases about the global elite and its plans. Britain has also refused to join the EU and continues to trade in pounds, not in euros. And Americans are not about to trade in amaros or some other new currency. National currency is seen as a symbol of sovereignty. Also, keeping the invasion of Libya alive and the Mideast in turmoil remains a high Bilderberg Group priority. Ohio Rep's anti-war stance should be supported by all. Editorial. By attempting to murder the leader of a foreign country who made no strike against America or Europe, NATO, a European defense alliance largely funded by U.S. taxpayers, violated U.S. and internationally accepted legal norms. U.S. Executive Order 12,333, which was signed by President Ronald Reagan, states no person employed by or acting on behalf of the U.S. government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination. In addition, assassination is generally accepted to be illegal under laws set forth at The Hague. Worse still, by agreeing to launch a NATO attack on Libya, Barack Obama usurped Congress's sole authority to declare war. Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat Ohio, has called the president's authorization of the war against Libya without congressional consent an impeachable offense. But while such realities loomed over his head, President Obama laughed and sipped champagne at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on April 30th, right when NATO forces fired missiles into his youngest son's home in Tripoli in an attempt to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi. This mission to murder the longtime Libyan leader was unsuccessful. However, his 29-year-old son and three grandchildren, all under 12 years of age, were slaughtered by NATO's precision airstrikes. For all the talk about this supposed peace president, Obama is easily as war-happy as the one preceding him, since the U.S.-NATO war machine killed these innocent non-combatants. In this sense, how are the individuals who commanded these attacks any different than war criminals in the Bush-Cheney administration? On March 18th, Obama assured the American public that our involvement in Libya would be days, not weeks, upon which time the U.S. military would then assume a mere supportive role. He also insisted that the United States place no boots on the ground. Yet, as veteran White House reporter Keith Koffler wrote on March 30th, CIA operatives have been on the ground in Libya directing airstrikes and gathering intel ever since this undeclared war began. Lies and misrepresentations are the order of the day. When George W. Bush was president, American Free Press, after researching the matter, labeled him a war criminal, as did many other honest politicians, journalists, and activists on both the right and the left. But while the Bush machine murdered countless innocents in Iraq and Afghanistan, now a precedent has been set that the U.S.-NATO combine can invade a country without any congressional approval and arbitrarily assassinate any foreign leader it pleases, no matter what the truth is about that leader. Obama's irresponsible violence can lead to nothing else but retaliation, justified retaliation. Many more Americans need to join with AFP and Ohio Democratic Representative Dennis Kucinich in denouncing Obama and company for starting yet another unnecessary, expensive, unconstitutional war. So let's call this killing of Libyans what it is, a despicable, impeachable, and un-American act. Page 8, AFP's Spotlight on Congress. Mission accomplished? Congress mulls bringing troops home from Afghanistan. Now that the world's most terrible terrorist mastermind has reportedly been executed in a nighttime raid in a wealthy exurb of the capital of Pakistan, pressure is building in Congress to declare victory in Afghanistan and bring the troops home. Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin, Democrat Illinois, said he originally supported the resolution in 2001 authorizing the U.S. military to go to war against Afghanistan. 10 years later, he said, it's time to call it over. Here we are 10 years later, said Durbin. If you asked me if I was signing up for the longest war in U.S. history with no end in sight, even with the killing of Osama bin Laden, that was not the bargain. That is not what I was signing up for. The war resolution that passed overwhelmingly following the September 11, 2001 attacks was for the purpose of going after Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. We were told that bin Laden was hiding out in a cave buried deep in the mountains in Afghanistan. Since 2001, U.S. soldiers have been risking their lives patrolling one of the toughest, most remote regions of the world, on the lookout for beady-eyed terrorists bent on destroying mainstream America. Ironically, if we are to believe the official story, it turns out bin Laden has been hiding for years in a $25 million compound 30 miles outside the capital of Pakistan. He was supposedly living among top Pakistani military officers and political figures. Regardless of whether readers accept the government's conspiracy theory, some legislators are saying enough is enough. It's time to get out of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Representative Walter Jones, Republican North Carolina, echoed this sentiment to a national news outlet, saying it's time to say we won and come home. Jones said he would be joining Representative Jim McGovern, Democrat Massachusetts, to introduce the Afghanistan Exit and Accountability Act. The bill will require Obama to submit to Congress a detailed timeline for bringing the troops home. This will include information on when the U.S. military will hand over all responsibilities to the Afghan government. While the measure does not go so far as to dictate an exact exit date, Jones wants a plan that brings U.S. soldiers home by the end of the year. A new poll released by Gallup found that 54% of Democrats believe the United States has achieved its goal in Afghanistan and should bring the troops home. But only 38% of Republicans agree. Some 59% of GOP members polled said the U.S. military should continue to occupy Afghanistan with no end date in sight. GOP may play hardball on debt ceiling. Freshman Senator Rand Paul, Republican Kentucky, said on May 2nd that he expects raising the debt ceiling will generate a lot of GOP opposition, more opposition than was generated by the agreement passed to fund the government for the rest of the 2011 fiscal year. If Paul is correct, it will make it tougher for congressional leaders to win the votes necessary to raise the ceiling, according to The Hill, a Capitol Hill daily. It would be particularly difficult for House Republican leaders who have had to wrestle with a number of conservatives that dug in and demanded more cuts in the 2011 spending. Debate. With regard to again raising the debt ceiling, many of the Republicans are now going to vote against it, Paul believes, as quoted on the Fox Business Network. More will vote against it than voted against the spending plans. I'm not sure exactly what the count will be. In the House, 59 Republicans voted against the spending bill, H.R. 1473. Roll call 268, April 14th, the Department of Defense and Full Year Appropriations Act of 2011. The House tally was 260 to 167, with 6 not voting. On the Senate side, 15 Republicans voted against the spending plan. The Hill noted GOP leaders will be able to win over more of their members if they can win spending cuts concessions from Democrats in the White House. Some Republicans want immediate spending cuts in exchange for authorizing an increase in the limit, but they also want structural reforms such as a proposed balanced budget amendment. When it comes to balancing the budget, legislators speak as if it's solely a spending problem when increasing tariffs on imports would bring in more federal revenue up front and help restore U.S. manufacturing, middle-class wages, and the tax base that funds the state and local governments. Republicans have maintained they don't view a default on U.S. debt as an option, though they've also considered not allowing a House vote if the Obama administration doesn't agree to sufficient concessions. The Treasury Department said that a vote to increase the debt limit must be held no later than August 2nd. But a basic problem is that a serious look into the particulars of the U.S. national debt and exactly what the federal government is really obligated to pay is not openly discussed in the halls of government. Some individuals involved in home foreclosures as well as credit card holders have challenged their debts rather than blindly paying them, trusted sources tell AFP, since the lending institutions involved have been found to violate basic contractual and economic principles, thus making the debts illegitimate. Dennis Kucinich speaks out against Obama doctrine. Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat Ohio, blasted the Obama administration for authorizing the assassination of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi in violation of U.S. law. Calling it the new Obama doctrine, Kucinich said the president has effectively laid the groundwork for future presidents to simply kill any foreign leader or dignitary with whom they may disagree. This attack underscores that the Obama doctrine of so-called humanitarian intervention appears to be a cover for regime change through assassination and murder, said Kucinich in an official press release. NATO's leaders have blood on their hands. NATO's airstrike seems to have been intended to carry out an illegal policy of assassination. This is a deep stain which we can never fully wash. This grave matter cannot be addressed with empty words. Words will not bring back dead children. Actions must be taken to stop more innocents from getting slaughtered. Page 10, AFP on the Mideast. Uprisings in Syria appear to be the work of foreign agitators, by Keith Johnson. On April 29th, this writer interviewed Jonathan Azazia, a prolific journalist and researcher specializing in international Zionism. Azazia is also a staff writer for Pakistan's opinion maker and editor for Mask of Zion. AFP asked Azazia about the Salafi groups triggering Syria's unrest. By all credible accounts, they appear to be proxies of a more nefarious hidden hand manipulating the so-called peaceful revolution. It was clear that there was something violently wrong with these Syrian protests from the beginning, said Azazia. In Syria, Assad enjoys an 80% approval rating. This is simply not the behavior of dignified Syrian people who have rejected sectarianism and have offered their full support to the Lebanese resistance in Iran. Azazia continued, in reality, the protesters are split between two foreign-backed camps, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, which is being manipulated and ordered around by Jordan and Saudi Arabia, two of Israel's greatest allies, and a more techno-savvy group of reformists which are being funded, guided, and organized by the Reform Party of Syria, a U.S.-based organization led by Farid al-Ghadri. Al-Ghadri is a Syrian exile who is a proud member of AIPAC, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and is known for being the first Syrian to give a speech to the Israeli Knesset. The Western voice of Syrian protests is Ammar Abdulhamid. According to Azazia, the mass media has already named him the Syrian Revolution spokesperson. But let's not forget that Abdulhamid is a fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, arguably the most influential Zionist think tank in the U.S. Azazia concluded, with these men, al-Ghadri and Abdulhamid, guiding the protests, coupled with the orchestrated chants of the Saudi-owned Syrian Muslim Brotherhood and the more recent outcries of Come Obama, Come Israel, Come Take Syria, Anything is Better Than Assad, it's very clear who is behind these protests and why they began. Meanwhile, the march to Iran continues. As the West finishes up Libya, the next domino to fall could be Syria, Iran's closest Arab ally and one of Israel's most coveted prizes in its drive to create a greater Israel. This long-held Zionist dream envisions a promised land that expands present Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates, encompassing all of the Arab Mideast. Oded Yanan, once a senior advisor at the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, laid out the blueprints for this ambitious plan in his 1982 paper entitled A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s that identified Iraq and Syria as Israel's primary target on the Eastern Front. Now that Iraq is in chaos, the Zionists have trained their sights on Syria. Using the recent Arab uprisings as cover, Israel's Mossad and its allies within the American and British intelligence communities have been working within the framework of foreign-funded color revolutions to incite violence, unrest, and instability. For several weeks, international media outlets have glamorized protests breaking out across Syria as grassroots resistance movements intent on taming Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. However, these so-called peaceful demonstrators have been running amok on the streets of Dara and elsewhere, tearing down monuments, torching buildings, and terrorizing citizens. Violence culminated over the Easter holiday when upwards of 120 civilians were reported killed, allegedly by Syrian troops and militiamen. Almost immediately, the International Committee of Jurists, which has repeatedly turned a blind eye to Israel's countless atrocities, threatened to indict Assad on war crimes. Following Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice called on the United Nations to impose sanctions against the Syrian government in response to outrageous and ongoing use of violence against peaceful protesters. The request was denied after Russia and India voiced their objections, citing numerous reports of Syrian forces being killed by armed insurgents. On April 19th, a few days prior to the violence that erupted in Dara, Bassam Abu Abdullah of the Al-Watan news agency in Damascus said that the protests were the work of Salafi groups, a minority faction of fanatical provocateurs imported by the West. Page 11, AFP on the War on Terror. Expect Terror War to Go on Forever, by Mark Anderson. whether the real Osama bin Laden actually died at the hands of U.S. Special Forces in Pakistan on May 1st is highly doubted in unofficial circles. But in any case, top officials say America's grueling 10-year war on terror will continue unabated. The American people will not be permitted to declare victory and bring the troops home now that the supposed leader of the world's largest terrorist enemy has been shot dead and, strangely, buried at sea, as the story goes. It'd be a big mistake to assume it's all over with, former Vice President Dick Cheney soberly told ABC News. President Obama added in a speech to the nation, "His death does not mark the end of our effort. There's no doubt that al-Qaeda will continue to pursue attacks against us. We must be vigilant at home and abroad." New CIA Director Leon Panetta added, "Though bin Laden is dead, al-Qaeda is not." This means America will continue filling the veterans' hospitals with the maimed, the disfigured, and the forgotten. The U.S. has sacrificed nearly 5,000 soldiers in drastically deflated official numbers to get bin Laden, yet this does not count the minimum of 50,000 actual war dead from all causes on all current war fronts, including those who died after battlefield service from cancers associated with depleted uranium munitions exposure, as Army Major Doug Rocky, retired, has told AFP. Disease and non-battle injuries, DNBI, historically claim more lives than those from direct combat, and soldier suicides, also not counted in official war death reports, often surpass actual battlefield deaths. Figures released by the armed services showed an alarming increase in suicides in 2010. Joe Donnelly wrote on Congress.org. Overall, the services reported 434 suicides by personnel on active duty, significantly more than the 381 suicides by active duty personnel reported in 2009. The 2010 total is below the 462 official deaths in combat, excluding accidents and illness. In 2009, active duty suicides exceeded deaths in battle. Architect Richard Gage has shown evidence of an inside job on 9/11, saying sophisticated explosives were used to demolish New York City's Twin Towers, considered far beyond al-Qaeda's access and capabilities. The research of physicist Stephen Jones supports Gage. Furthermore, researcher Craig Ranke and firsthand witness April Gallup have cast enormous doubt on the story that a commercial airliner hit the Pentagon. And photographs show a total lack of discernible plane wreckage at the supposed crash site in Shanksville, PA. Page 12, AFP on the death of Osama bin Laden. The NWO's Ultimate Bogeyman by Victor Thorne. Before anyone buys into the premise that Osama bin Laden's death was faked for political purposes, they must first accept the premise that 9/11 was a staged false flag terror attack executed by elements within the Israeli government and U.S. neocons. The 19 Muslim hijackers and al-Qaeda served as nothing more than convenient patsies, with bin Laden becoming the ultimate bogeyman. In the decades since this horrific event, the U.S. taxpayers have spent over $1 trillion, $700 billion in Iraq and $400 billion in Afghanistan, fighting Israel's wars. While college students cheered in front of the White House and others celebrated bin Laden's demise in Times Square, they failed to comprehend one vital fact. America's economy is being bankrupted by a military-industrial banking machine that, at least in part, resulted from our continuing war on terror. For nearly 10 years, bin Laden stood at the center of this perpetual war, an enemy that could be everywhere, nowhere, or any place in between. But few realize that the CIA originally created this 6-foot-5-inch 9/11 mastermind in the late 1970s after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Oddly enough, bin Laden's relatives had been engaging in business deals with the Bush family since the early 1970s. Around the same time as the Vietnam War came to a close, the CIA needed greener pastures for its lucrative opium trade. So, after Russia's humiliating defeat, Afghanistan's drug trade flourished as bin Laden became the undisputed leader of al-Qaeda. After a major oil deal went awry and U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East became a major stumbling block, a break ensued between the Taliban and Western leaders. Unable to resolve their disputes, those in the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, decided that they needed a new Pearl Harbor to once again get Americans primed for a series of long, protracted wars. PNAC advocates simply couldn't unleash an unprovoked attack on Afghanistan and Iraq, so the invention of a new enemy was a prerequisite. It is believed bin Laden, a longtime CIA asset who was suffering from kidney failure in the months preceding 9/11, died in December 2001. But his death didn't stop U.S. and Israeli leaders and the controlled media from making him a poster boy for global terrorism, a role he held until he was finally killed off a second time in Pakistan. Terrorist Osama bin Laden is dead, yet again, by Paul Craig Roberts. If today were April 1st and not May 2nd, we could dismiss as an April Fool's joke the headline that Osama bin Laden was killed in a firefight in Pakistan and quickly buried at sea. As it is, we must take it as more evidence that the U.S. government has unlimited belief in the gullibility of Americans. Think about it. What are the chances that a person allegedly suffering from kidney disease and requiring dialysis and, in addition, afflicted with diabetes and low blood pressure, survived in mountain hideaways for a decade? If bin Laden was able to acquire dialysis equipment and medical care that his condition required, would not the shipment of dialysis equipment point to his location? Why did it take 10 years to find him? Consider also the claims repeated by a triumphalist U.S. media celebrating bin Laden's death that bin Laden used his millions to bankroll terrorist training camps in Sudan, the Philippines, and Afghanistan, sending holy warriors to foment revolution and fight with fundamentalist Muslim forces across North Africa, in Chechnya, Tajikistan, and Bosnia. That's a lot of activity for mere millions to bankroll. Perhaps the U.S. should have put him in charge of the Pentagon. But the main question is, how was bin Laden able to move his money about? What banking system was helping him? The U.S. government succeeds in seizing the assets of people and of entire countries, Libya being the most recent. Why not bin Laden's money? Was he carrying around with him $100 million in gold coins and sending emissaries to distribute payments to his far-flung operations? The morning headlines have the odor of a staged event. The smell reeks from the triumphalist news reports loaded with exaggerations, from celebrants waving flags and chanting USA, USA. Could something else be going on? No doubt President Obama is in desperate need of a victory. He committed a fool's error of restarting the war in Afghanistan, and now, after a decade of fighting, the U.S. faces stalemate, if not defeat. The wars of the Bush-Obama regimes have bankrupted the United States, leaving huge deficits and a declining dollar in their wake, and re-election time is approaching. The various lies and deceptions, such as weapons of mass destruction, of the last several administrations had terrible consequences for the United States and the world. But not all deceptions are the same. Remember, the entire reason for invading Afghanistan in the first place was to get bin Laden. Now that President Obama has declared bin Laden to have been shot in the head by U.S. Special Forces, operating in an independent country and buried at sea, there is no reason for continuing the war against the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and the people of Afghanistan. Perhaps the precipitous decline of the U.S. dollar in foreign exchange markets has forced some real budget reductions, which can only come from stopping the open-ended wars. Until the decline of the dollar reached the breaking point, bin Laden, whom many experts believe to have been dead for years, was a useful bogeyman to use to feed the profits of the U.S. military security banking complex. Page 13, AFP on the death of Osama bin Laden. Obama versus Osama, a very convenient death, by Victor Thorne. The compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, 75 miles north of Islamabad, where Osama bin Laden supposedly met his demise on May 1st at the hands of a highly sensitive U.S. ground operation, was 8 times larger than any other building in the area. Built in 2005, these headquarters described as a highly unusual structure were well guarded and extremely secure. Didn't anyone in our military or intelligence community for 6 long years question the purpose of this fortress or the identity of its occupants? $25 million reward lingered over bin Laden's head, yet not a single person revealed the whereabouts of the world's most famous terrorist. With the NSA's technological capabilities, not to mention the precision of Google Earth, was no one in our multi-billion dollar spook industry capable of locating a Muslim who stands 6'4" and drags around a dialysis machine? Only moments after Barack Obama announced the death of this Orwellian perpetual enemy, former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley proclaimed, "Osama bin Laden was hiding in clear view." Was Hadley's statement accurate, or is it a bit inconvenient to mention that the Egyptian newspaper Al-Waft ran a funeral announcement for bin Laden on December 26, 2001? Multiple other reports from a wide variety of sources ranging back years flatly stated in one version or another that bin Laden has long been dead. AFP has diligently chronicled such reports that largely seem to have been missed or otherwise suppressed by the elite media in the United States. Even more incredibly, White House officials described how, according to their version of events, the first intelligence threads pointing to bin Laden's Pakistani locale arrived in August 2010. Still, he purportedly wasn't killed for another 8 months. How many people can go that long without paying parking tickets, let alone when you are the most wanted man in the world? Bin Laden's supposed homicide arrived at a time when Obama's popularity had plummeted to a dangerously low point. Tycoon Donald Trump hammered him for a month straight with allegations concerning his birth certificate, while also calling Obama the worst president ever. Amid this onslaught, Obama teetered, appearing weak as gas prices skyrocketed, the economy sputtered, and the war against Libya faced ruin. NATO's April 30th assassination attempt on Muammar Gaddafi had backfired, with the Libyan president's son and three grandchildren killed as collateral damage. Global reaction was mounting to the point of outrage as it became clear that the U.S., under the guise of NATO, violated international law by trying to murder a foreign leader. Obama, like his predecessors George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, was soon to be labeled a war criminal. But then, just one day later, Bin Laden was reported dead and Obama was hailed as a heroic dragon slayer. Is it of any symbolic significance that this announcement came on May 1st, the Communist International Workers' Day? At any rate, celebrations soon ensued outside the White House as the jubilant and gullible sang God Bless America and the Star-Spangled Banner. While addressing the nation, Obama took credit for the operation, boasting, "I directed Leon Panetta, CIA director, to make the capture of Osama bin Laden our number one priority. I authorized the operation to get bin Laden. It came at my direction." Obama's popularity numbers will rise, and GOP criticism of him will be more difficult for a while. However, the question arises, why didn't Republican George W. Bush and his cronies pull off a similar ploy and stake their claim by killing bin Laden? Those who believe that the world and American political affairs are actually far more stage-managed than meets the eye, that much of the partisan conflict we see is actually political theater, provide this answer. If Bush had made good on his threat of getting bin Laden dead or alive, he'd have emerged victorious in his war on terror, and Obama's selection as president would have been more difficult. The powers that be needed Bush's tenure to end on a disastrous note so that the doors could be opened for Obama's hope and change. So with Obama's favorability ratings tanking and a power struggle in Washington threatening to reveal many scandalous aspects of his past, the president's handlers countered by pulling the ultimate trump card, the head of bin Laden. Of course, the neoconservatives who manage U.S. foreign policy couldn't blow the whistle on this ruse because, after all, they were the first ones to use bin Laden as a patsy after their false flag attacks on September 11, 2001. In all, the rewards for Obama are obvious. Often criticized as being un-American and tepid on foreign affairs, he now boasted about the greatness of our country during his late-night address to the nation. On a larger scale, even the military machine, mired in a disastrous Afghan war for nearly a decade, may emerge on a positive note. Despite squandering over $400 billion battling Afghan tribes, General David Petraeus is being hailed as a hero for commandeering the drone attacks on Pakistan. Moreover, the Department of Defense's message will clearly be, "Our efforts weren't in vain because we got bin Laden." In the second line of Obama's May 1st address, the president reiterated that al-Qaeda and bin Laden were responsible for 9/11, and only through the tireless and heroic work of our military was the U.S. able to combat global terrorism. U.S. will not release photos of dead Osama bin Laden. On the fact that the U.S. government will not release pictures of the dead Osama, the risks of release outweigh the benefits, said Representative Mike Rogers, Republican Michigan, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee. Conspiracy theorists around the world will claim the photos are doctored anyway, and there is a real risk that releasing the photos will only serve to inflame public opinion in the Middle East. Page 14, Behind the Scenes. The Plot Against Free Speech by Michael Collins Piper. Former Senator Rick Santorum, Republican Pennsylvania, is an appealing candidate to many conservatives, but he does have a dark side. Although he fervently declared in 2006 that the American people have always rallied to the cause of freedom, just a few years earlier Santorum planned a war against a traditional American liberty, freedom of speech. In 2003, Santorum planned to introduce ideological diversity legislation that would cut federal funding for American universities found to be permitting professors, students, and student organizations to openly criticize Israel. Santorum considered criticism of Israel to be anti-Semitism. Santorum wanted to rewrite the federal funding formula under Title IX of the Higher Education Act to include ideological diversity as a prerequisite for federal funding. Joining Santorum was another pro-Israel ideologue, then-Senator Sam Brownback, Republican Kansas, who had his own scheme to institute a federal commission. critics called it a tribunal, to be established under Title IX to investigate anti-Semitism on American campuses. Although the average student or academic had not heard of the scheme, Wayne Firestone, director of the Center for Israel Affairs for the Hillel Foundation, said that, "Everywhere I go, this is the lead topic. This is drawing a lot of interest." It was Hillel, a national network of pro-Israel student-manned campus police, that first leaked word of Santorum's scheme. Further details appeared on April 15, 2003, in the New York Sun, a pro-Israel daily published by a clique of billionaire financiers. Hillel told supporters that Santorum and several GOP senators, including Brownback, now governor of Kansas, had invited representatives of a number of Jewish organizations to attend a private meeting on Capitol Hill to discuss concerns about growing criticism of Israel on campuses. At the meeting were the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, of B'nai B'rith, the Zionist Organization of America, the American Jewish Committee, and Hillel. In the meantime, word of the Santorum initiative was spreading as a result of an expose by American Free Press. Widely circulated on the internet, the AFP report arrived in the emails of educators across the United States and around the globe. As a consequence of growing concern about the scheme, the pro-Israel lobby began denying Santorum had proposed such legislation, claiming the AFP story was a lie. Ultimately, the New York-based Jewish Week reported on May 9, 2003, that the State Department had contacted senators to advise them that Palestinian newspapers were carrying the story about Santorum and asking if the story was true. Jewish Week's story, titled Diversity Disinformation, declared a rumor of pending legislation barring campus criticism of Israel was sweeping Arab and left-wing media. The article asserted that the story originated with conspiracy theorists and Holocaust revisionists. Obviously, this was a lie since AFP's report was based on a story in a pro-Israel newspaper. Despite this, Jewish Week said the story has become an article of faith throughout the Arab world and in some U.S. left-wing circles, and asserted that to pro-Israel leaders and leading members of the Senate, it's a dangerous urban legend at best, deliberate disinformation at worst. The article in the pro-Israel Sun stated flatly in discussing the Capitol Hill meeting where the scheme originated, "By the end of the meeting yesterday, Mr. Santorum was talking about introducing legislation that could cut federal funding to colleges where anti-Semitism and anti-Israel sentiments are prevalent, or more generally, where ideological diversity is lacking." Yet, now that the story has been unveiled, Jewish Week contradicted the Sun and claimed that no such legislation has been introduced or even contemplated. According to an unnamed source cited by Jewish Week, the Capitol Hill meeting featured many presentations from different groups, failing to mention that the different groups were all pro-Israel organizations. The new version of events, as outlined by Jewish Week, never mentioned that Santorum's colleague, Brownback, had urged formation of a federal commission to investigate so-called anti-Semitism on campus. So, if the story was an urban legend, why did a pro-Israel newspaper publish the story in the first place? As a candidate for president, Santorum should be forced to address the controversy surrounding this matter. Page 15, AFP and the Global Elite. 200 Billionaires Paying No Taxes, by James P. Tucker, Jr. David Rockefeller and 200 of his billionaire buddies pay no income taxes. David, now 96, does, however, get more than $200,000 a year from taxpayers as a small farmer. These billionaire tax dodgers, including Paul Mellon and Texas oil man Bunker Hunt, were exposed by the Washington Star, which folded on August 7, 1981. Rich tax dodgers hire platoons of lawyers and accountants who specialize in evading the law. They create layers of trusts and closely held companies where no public reports are required. Inquiries by outsiders are rebuffed, but the rich boys' expenses for operating the trust can be awesome, traveling by private jet owned by the trust and living high. The Rockefellers' tax dodging goes far back. When Judge Kenesaw Landis ordered Standard Oil broken up in 1911, John D. Rockefeller created new trusts and gave his stock to them. The net effect was the same as if you took your wallet out of your left pocket and placed it in your right pocket, said the internet site WEPIN.com. In doing what he did, Rockefeller not only managed to avoid income taxes, he also escaped probate, estate, and inheritance taxes, taxes that have ravaged the wealth of those not in the know about trusts. Rockefeller is a luminary in secretive international organizations such as the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission, whose elitist members also duck taxes while trying to hike taxes for mere citizens of the United States. You have read much in AFP about huge corporations that pay petty or no taxes. These include British Petroleum, no federal income tax in 2010, ExxonMobil, no tax in 2009 despite a first quarter profit of $10.7 billion, up 69% from the first quarter of 2010, Royal Dutch Shell, a first quarter profit of $6.3 billion, up 30% from 2010, and General Electric, major profits but no tax payment. Page 16, one-on-one with Dave Gahary. Pastor burns the Quran but ignores a real book of hate, the Talmud, by Dave Gahary. Florida-based pastor Terry Jones is prepared to pay the price for what he believes in. It's a quest to educate the world about, in his words, the radical element of Islam. Specifically, Jones is concerned with two aspects of Islam, jihad, the struggle to defend Islam, and Sharia, its religious law. During an exclusive 90-minute interview with American Free Press, Jones, who spent nearly 30 years as a missionary in Germany, made clear his views on Islam and why he and his supporters consider the religion to be a threat to the U.S. Constitution and the freedom Americans experience through that document. Jones was straightforward. We have lost quite a bit as far as our real freedom of speech here in America. It has been our experience that as long as you stay on the surface of our society, everything seems to be just fine. If you begin to rock the boat, if you begin to raise issues that are uncomfortable that people do not want to see or recognize, you receive an enormous amount of pressure from either the government or from different agencies. Jones operates through the Gainesville-based Dove World Outreach Center, which gained notoriety last year when the church had threatened to burn a Quran, Islam's holy book. The event was canceled after Jones received a personal call from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. I only spent a few minutes with him on the phone, explained Jones. It was a very good conversation. He was, of course, very cordial. He didn't really put any pressure on me. He just simply asked if I would reconsider the burning of the Quran. On March 20th, however, Dove World held an event called International Judge the Quran Day, where the Quran was brought up on three charges during a mock trial. This time, Jones received no official pleas for moderation. We did not get any calls or any contact at all from the government, said Jones. We wanted to give the Muslim community a chance to answer our claims, said Jones, so we decided to put the Quran on trial. It is still our belief that if the Quran is strictly followed, it does or can lead to radical activities, to terrorist activities. Through a traditional Western trial scenario with judge, jury, and attorneys, the Quran was accused of three charges: the training and promoting of terrorist activities around the world, the death, rape, and torture of people worldwide whose only crime is not being of the Islamic faith, and crimes against women and Christians through promotion of prejudice against anyone who is not a Muslim. The Quran was found guilty on all three charges, said Jones. We had four choices on our website: burning, drowning, shredding, and a firing squad. People were allowed to vote, and they chose burning. So after the Quran was found guilty on those three charges, it was burned. Video of the burning on the internet created a firestorm across several Muslim countries. At least 20 people were reportedly killed as a result of Jones' action. When you heard about this, asked AFP, what was your reaction? We were devastated. It's terrible anytime someone is killed, murdered, or someone's life is cut short, explained Jones. But we personally feel no responsibility. Jones continued, the people who did this and the countries who allow this because of their religious beliefs, lack of human rights, civil rights, and proper laws should be held accountable. They should be forced to change their laws, or in our opinion, they should be removed from the UN. Jones targeted Dearborn, Michigan as a site to raise awareness of the threat he perceives. AFP asked if he selected the town because it has a high population of Muslims. That would be the main reason, said Jones. Their Islamic center is the largest in America, so we felt it would be an appropriate place to raise awareness concerning jihad and Sharia. Events held on April 22nd and 29th resulted in jail time for Jones. A judge ordered him to stay away from the Islamic Center of America for 3 years. Undeterred, Jones plans on returning to Dearborn. One wonders, however, why Jones is not focusing on a real book of hate, the Jewish Talmud, which attacks Christianity, Jesus, and his mother Mary in the most vile of ways. Of course, that would get him into some real trouble, so best to avoid it and keep on trying to convince people Islam is our real enemy, even though Talmud worshippers are far more powerful in the United States than those who believe in the Quran. Page 17, AFP on the Israel Lobby. Countering AIPAC's Massive Power by Dave Gahary. If you've ever wanted to learn more about the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, and rub shoulders with people from over 100 organizations committed to countering the corrosive influence of the lobby, now's your chance. Medea Benjamin of Code Pink and Global Exchange fame has set her sights on AIPAC and is determined to break AIPAC's circle of influence. The influence she's alluding to, of course, is Israel's almost complete control of the U.S. Congress. Ms. Benjamin, a peace activist since high school, is the main organizer of the event called Move Over AIPAC that is scheduled to take place from May 21st through May 24th in Washington, D.C., at the same exact time as AIPAC's conference. AIPAC is billing its event as the largest policy conference in AIPAC history and will be holding its gathering at the exquisite Walter E. Washington Convention Center, with those in attendance expected to number over 10,000. Right across the street at Mount Vernon Place United Methodist Church will be the activists at the Move Over AIPAC gathering. Ms. Benjamin hopes that through the 12 workshops, panels, and plenary discussions and more, participants will learn about why AIPAC is so powerful, how it functions, and ways to loosen its stranglehold on Mideast foreign policy. Accompanying the workshops and discussions, creative protests will be employed, including the building of a replica of the wall in the West Bank. One of the highlights of the event will be protests outside the Washington Convention Center, where, according to AIPAC's website, some of the keynote speakers will include Benjamin Netanyahu, Representative John Boehner, Republican Ohio, Senator Harry Reid, Democrat Nevada, Representative Eric Cantor, Republican Virginia, Representative Steny Hoyer, Democrat Maryland, and Jim Woolsey, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. It is estimated that at least half of all U.S. congresspersons will attend the conference. According to Ms. Benjamin, the little-known yet extremely powerful lobby helps to write congressional legislation in Israel's favor to the detriment of an even-handed policy that would promote real peace in the Middle East. She feels AIPAC should be registered as a foreign agent according to the Foreign Agents Registration Act and not classified as a charity. Ms. Benjamin feels AIPAC's main goal is to continue U.S. taxpayer funding of Israel, a wealthy country, and she questions the wisdom of such a policy, especially in light of the fiscal shape of the U.S. and the suffering of many of her citizens, Israel's continued building of illegal settlements, its siege on the open-air prison camp called Gaza with its 1.5 million residents, and the daily abuses committed against Palestinians who have had their land illegally seized by the colonial power. Keynote speakers at Move Over AIPAC will be Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, authors of the 2007 book The Israel Lobby, which, according to Ms. Benjamin, created a firestorm by meticulously documenting how AIPAC helps Israel and hurts the U.S. For a full list of speakers and to register, visit the website moveoverapac.org or call 415-235-6517. Page 18, AFP on Cultural Communism. Political correctness is a conspiracy, by the staff of American Free Press. Bill Clinton, Al Gore, former UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Microsoft's Bill Gates, and Google founder Larry Page have all spoken at TED gatherings. Although still relatively unknown except in rarefied elitist circles, TED, an acronym for Technology Education Design, is emerging as one of the globalists' most influential think tanks. TED is the latest example of cultural Marxism, similar to the Fabian Society, the Frankfurt School, and the Bauhaus movement, whose agenda involves reshaping our culture through various forms of social engineering. It's called political correctness. Reminiscent of past elites such as Cecil Rhodes of British Roundtable fame and 18th century Illuminati founder Adam Weishaupt, TED is an adjunct of the Sapling Foundation, whose owner Chris Anderson wants to leverage media, technology, market forces, and the power of ideas to tackle tough global issues. Richard Saul Werman, an information architect, created the notion of TED conferences. But when some of their speakers suggest the notion of population reduction, it's merely an updated version of past ideas promoted by Charles Darwin's inspiration, Thomas Malthus, and other population control thinkers. Today, Werman and TED use computers and cutting-edge gadgetry as ways of mapping a future that they deem best for society. Google, Microsoft, Facebook, and Apple comprise an information conglomerate that is leading the masses toward what many believe to be their own demise. To be sure, the information superhighway is useful and helpful in many ways, but while everyone is simultaneously ensnared in a modernistic worldwide web, this far-reaching net is also creating a dehumanized society where people rarely have to leave their own self-created universe. In 1884, the London-based Fabian Society emerged as a group of intellectuals promoting the idea of utopian socialism. Founded by literary elitist George Bernard Shaw and economist Sidney Webb, their later devotees included science fiction writer H.G. Wells, progressive educator John Dewey, Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, the ACLU's Harold Lasky, and attorney Clarence Darrow, who sought to make the theory of evolution part of every school curriculum. Webb eventually launched the highly influential London School of Economics that, after receiving a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, shaped monetary policy by promoting the government intervention ideas of British economist John Maynard Keynes. But the real crux of Fabianism may be found in the designs of Professor Graham Wallace, who stated, "The object of social psychology is to control human conduct." In addition to laying the foundation for public opinion shapers such as Sigmund Freud's influential nephew, Edward Bernays, author of the seminal book Propaganda, the Fabians also envisioned a reorganization of society through various legislative processes. By planting Fabian lawyers and Fabian judges throughout the U.S. court system, they could then use legal technicalities to further their aims while still superficially honoring the Constitution. Moreover, government officials could appoint bureaucrats to lead America and Europe toward a communist-style goal of godless totalitarianism. The Fabian intelligentsia believed that a select class could infiltrate universities and indoctrinate generations of students with anti-free enterprise, anti-private property ideas. Sidney Webb, similar to oil mogul John D. Rockefeller, supported protected business monopolies because, according to them, competition is a sin. Of course, in their own minds, the Fabians thought they knew it was best for the rest of society or mere commoners. And if the unwashed masses didn't appreciate their efforts, noted playwright Shaw offered this solution. "If it were discovered that you had not character and industry enough to be worth all this trouble," wrote Shaw, "you might possibly be executed in a kindly manner." During the 1920s, Weimar Germany was infected with some of the world's most scandalous arts and entertainment. One of the more esoteric arms of this radical experimentation was the Bauhaus School. Founded by architect Walter Gropius, the Bauhaus movement's modernist aims were to create an entirely new guild of craftsmen that weren't separated by class distinctions. Another aspect of this cultural movement revolved around unifying the arts, technology, and a form of minimalist futurism. Elitist in nature despite their pleas for equality, Bauhaus architects defined their utopia as buildings of the future. To achieve this end, they turned to cold and ugly machinery, steel-framed high-rises, glass and concrete as the epitome of beauty. Our cities testify to their influence. Critics, though, decried the sameness and monotonous qualities of their structures, comparing them to a type of architectural muzak. As urban dwellings became an emerging phenomenon, Bauhaus depersonalized city life as cacophonies of noise trapped inside metropolitan canyons. Rather than the bucolic peacefulness of their agrarian forefathers, humans were now submerged in technological maelstroms of honking car horns, police sirens, smog, and traffic jams, all the while being surrounded and subsumed by an architecture that conveyed tedium and a pervasive lack of emotion. After murdering 25 million Russians in order to establish communism, the Bolsheviks knew that they couldn't achieve their goal of world conquest with such brutal methods. So in 1923, Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci and partner Georgi Lukács, the top communist theoretician since Marx and Lenin, founded the Institute of Social Research, later to be known as the Frankfurt School. These men devised a strategy based on psychological warfare in order to conquer the West and subvert its perception of reality so that communism was not seen as the enemy. Later, Theodore Adorno wrote a book called The Authoritarian Personality that became the basis of this subversive movement. By incorporating Freudian psychoanalysis into Marxism, they established a premise that white men were rooted in evil because they suffered from a mental illness called authoritarian personality that caused them to oppress and victimize others. They argued that Western culture was a product of that illness and had to be destroyed. In this light, Marxist intellectual Lukács asked, "Who will save us from Western civilization?" After Adolf Hitler took power in Germany, the Frankfurt School was driven out and forced to relocate to Columbia University in New York. Although most people have never heard of these individuals, they've been the chief architects of America's cultural demise from World War II to today. These societal engineers were instrumental in distorting our perception of art, which they designed to alienate people from the civilization surrounding them. Lukács linked art with social struggle, feeling it should be ugly in order to reflect the repression and alienation in Western culture. This concept was also applied to architecture, music, and literature. In fact, the entire 1960s cultural revolution, falsely attributed to the baby boom phenomenon, was actually the fruit of the Frankfurt School's labors. The civil rights movement, feminism, beatniks, the Beatles, and hippies were all the fruit of their subversive ideas. The goal was to undermine the authority of men of European extraction so that they could steal it from them. Blacks, women, and children all were pitted against white males, and in some cases against each other, while religion was ridiculed and genuine patriotism lost its luster. Today, Frankfurt School ideology has morphed into political correctness that uses so-called hate speech laws to render patriots powerless to speak out against multiculturalism, homosexual marriage, illegal immigration, affirmative action, and any other assault on civilization. World's Billionaires Want to Be Our Social Engineers by Keith Hansen. Its name is TED. It's here to help us. TED is actually an acronym for Technology, Education, Design, the three original sectors of global enterprise from which certain thought leaders emerge to share their visions for a better world. But some people contend TED is the modern equivalent of the Frankfurt School and the Bauhaus movement, which seek to destroy traditional Western culture. TED was born out of collaborations between Richard Saul Wurman, an architect and graphic designer credited with coining the term architect-engineer, and Harry Marx, a pioneer in broadcast design and computer-generated imagery. In 1984, Wurman and Marx first hosted a conference to exchange ideas in the aforementioned areas. Their stated mission, in part, was to spread ideas in the belief that the power of ideas can change attitudes, lives, and ultimately the world. Their goal was to build a clearinghouse that offers free knowledge and inspiration from the world's most inspired thinkers, and also a community of curious souls to engage with ideas and each other. TED's intelligence, as Bill Gates gushed about the cumulative IQ of its conference's attendees, is incredible, he said. However, in a February 2010 TED presentation, Gates advocated his misanthropic support of depopulation by suggesting that vaccines could be used to reduce world population figures. TED also smacks of elitism with a standard annual membership fee of $7,500, while the highest price membership is $125,000. TED also broaches the issue of socialist control over government, which is looming ever larger in the United States. Do we really want billionaires who were never elected to public office dictating policy to our government and governments across the globe? It's a question that shouldn't be brushed aside, especially after last year's unveiling of a Giving Pledge initiative that challenges billionaires to donate most of their money to philanthropic causes. How did that work out? According to Giving Pledge's official website, 50 billionaires have signed on to support the pledge to give the majority of their wealth to charity. So far, there is no clear indication any of them has actually done it. These self-congratulatory elites have a messianic view, as if their very thoughts have godlike qualities and paint a flawless path to the future. History is littered with utopian plans that wrought hardship, misery, decline, and destruction. TED likely is the current manifestation of such a best-laid plan. So watch out for TED. It's well-funded and active. Page 21, High-Level Crime and Corruption. Bioethics Commission Ignores Modern-Day Abuses by Victor Thorne. One of the stated purposes of a hand-picked panel known as the Bioethics Commission is to apologize for past abuses committed by the U.S. government, some of which included the noted Tuskegee syphilis experiment, various unwarranted radiation tests, and unwitting Guatemalan subjects infected with sexually transmitted diseases. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called the Guatemalan STD case clearly unethical. "I beg you, please help us," said citizen Lisa Becker on March 1st when Obama's Bioethics Commission met in Washington, D.C. Her gripping words were directed to Amy Gutman, the head of this panel that is ostensibly concerned with past abuses, even as present-day abuses are tossed in a padded room, so to speak. The dark annals of history also chronicle covert CIA agents giving unsuspecting Johns hallucinogenic drugs and Dr. Ewan Cameron's barbaric sleep room experiments in Canadian mental hospitals. However, the Bioethics Commission faced an unexpected moment during its public comment session March 1st when 20 speakers delivered a powerfully distinct message. Non-consensual human experiments are still being conducted on thousands of Americans to this very day, and they want these abuses to stop. On April 20th, this AFP writer participated in a conference call with many of the individuals who appeared in Washington before the commission. One woman, 36-year-old Tammy Battaglia, described the process of brain mapping and said she had been taken to a laboratory at CIA headquarters in Langley. Ms. Battaglia and others stressed that this type of abuse can even negatively affect other family members. She told the commission, "I have not consented to be experimented on by any branch of the government, military, or members of the American Medical Association. Nobody should have the right to maim or torture any other person or to treat them in a cruel manner that I have been treated under the guise of national security." Ken Rhodes sent a videotape of the open microphone testimony to this writer, and what unfolded on March 1st was riveting. Texas Dr. John Hall spoke of an alarming rate of complaints associated with the use of radiation weapons that are debilitating victims. Author Alan Hornblum, who has written on the use of prison inmates and children as test subjects, emphasized, "Medical ethics is an orphan in today's medical arena." Others that day reported burns on their bodies, from torture, RFID tracking chips, the Navy's Project Medusa microwave weaponry, the implantation of false memories, and additional forms of psychological torture. During our conference call, John Peter Rosenholm delved into the subject of subvocal speech recognition before broaching the topic of a patented Army procedure that utilized voice-to-skull devices, or V2K. The Army's own website describes V2K as a neuroelectromagnetic device which uses microwave transmission of sound into the skull of persons by way of pulse-modulated microwave radiation. Rosenholm also warned that the government can falsely place someone in the hospital, then have a free ticket to do anything it wants. Another man known to AFP readers, former FBI agent Ted Gunderson, exposed the concept of organized gang stalking, whereby targeted individuals are subjected to around-the-clock surveillance and harassment by rogue elements within law enforcement and the intelligence community. Considering the long, well-documented history of secretive intelligence programs such as MKUltra, if U.S. congressmen are fair game for mind control, should anyone be surprised that tests are still being conducted on everyday citizens without their consent? Or, as Gunderson commented, this makes the old COINTELPRO program look like a Boy Scout jamboree. Saddest of all, the public rarely sees a glimpse of these extreme tortures because when the 20 victims approached Ms. Gutman and her bioethics commission, every member of the media present that day stood up and immediately left. All of these so-called journalists showed that they are more willing to promote the Obama agenda by focusing on past horrors while ignoring the people still being abused today. Page 22, Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. America's poor grade from Standard & Poor's is alarming, by Jim Trafficant. One of the most important credit agencies in the world issued an unusual and unprecedented financial warning to the U.S. government. For the first time, the Standard & Poor's agency urged Congress to get a grip on its finances or risk losing the nation's sterling credit rating. And that's not all of it. Standard & Poor's lowered its long-term financial outlook for America's fiscal health from stable to negative. The prestigious credit agency warned of serious consequences if U.S. lawmakers fail to control the massive and growing federal deficit. This could strip the U.S. government of its top investment rating in the next 2 years. Such a loss of the AAA rating would send shockwaves through the world economy, making loans more expensive and credit more difficult to obtain for Americans. It's difficult for the average person to obtain those things even now. This downgrade is no passing matter. This is a serious warning, folks, a time in U.S. history that has finally arrived due to the foolish federal trade and tax policies. If you doubt the severity of this development, think about this. The analysts at Standard & Poor's have never before used any forecast to cast doubt on the credit worthiness of the U.S. Here's the big picture. The U.S. government is on track to reach a record $1.5 trillion deficit this year. If that's not enough to fry your calculator, this will be the third consecutive deficit exceeding $1 trillion. But Washington politicians say everything will be fine. They point to the creation of new jobs. Well, check this out. McDonald's says it hired 24% more people than planned. The hamburger outlet said its franchises hired 62,000 new workers, even though they had planned to hire only 50,000 this year. However, McDonald's Corp. had more than 1 million applicants for these jobs. That's McUnbelievable. Truth is, there are not many jobs out there that pay more than burger flipper wages. And while there's nothing inherently wrong with flipping hamburgers, the problem is that our entire economy has become a service economy. America is once again a colony, a plaything of corporations. China is at the forefront of those foreign nations that prey upon America's marketplace. It's getting so bad that the International Monetary Fund has projected that by the year 2016, China will overtake the USA in real economic output. That's right, the IMF says China will be number one, the strongest economy in the world, and it will not be our close ally. The United States has confronted more hostile enemies before, but we never had to contend with a rival that matched us in economic strength. I can recall asking for the resignation of then Attorney General Janet Reno for failing to investigate a $10 million campaign contribution to President Bill Clinton from a general in the Chinese Army. China ended up with permanent most favored nation trade status and has been cleaning our clock ever since. I said on the House floor, Russia is a fly on our face. China is a dragon about to eat our assets. It has come to pass. I do not trust China, which takes close to $400 billion in trade surplus with Uncle Sam every year. China is buying nuclear subs, missiles, and jets with our money and laughing all the way. By the way, if Congress cuts $100 billion from the deficit this year, the deficit will only be $1.4 trillion. And some politicians say it's too drastic. Beam me up and get back at me. The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan. Weather manipulation no longer a wild conspiracy theory by Vince Ryan. In any discussion of weather control, a working definition is necessary. According to Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia, weather control is the act of manipulating or altering certain aspects of the environment to produce desirable changes in weather. Weather control can have the goal of preventing damaging weather, such as hurricanes or tornadoes, from occurring, of causing beneficial weather, such as rainfall in an area experiencing drought, or of provoking damaging weather against an enemy or rival as a tactic of military or economic warfare. Weather modification and warfare has been banned by the United Nations. Note that this definition is an admission that weather control exists for both good and bad applications. And recently, many states were hit by deadly tornadoes while earthquakes have been ravaging the globe. Their damage is similar to that wrought by Hurricane Fran in September 1996 when this writer lived in Raleigh, North Carolina. Pine trees crushed houses, utilities were out for over a week, and the National Guard was mobilized and patrolled the neighborhoods to prevent looting. It was a tense time, but most people worked together. Meanwhile, Wikipedia reports, in January 2011, several newspapers and magazines, including the UK's Sunday Times and Arabian Business, reported that scientists backed by the government of Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, had created over 50 artificial rainstorms between July and August 2010. The report added, the artificial rainstorms were said to have sometimes caused hail, gales, and thunderstorms, baffling local residents. The scientists reportedly used ionizers to create the rainstorms, and although the results are disputed, the large number of times it is recorded to have rained right after the ionizers were switched on during a usually dry season is encouraging to those who support the experiment. Cloud seeding is the decades-old technique whereby small particles such as silver iodide are sprayed to trigger cloud formation. It works only when water vapor is present in the air. Countries using this technique include the U.S., China, India, and Russia. Enter HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program facility located in the remote Gakona region of Alaska and associated with the University of Alaska, the Office of Naval Research, and the Air Force Research Laboratory, among numerous other parties. HARP's stated main goal is basic science research of the uppermost portion of the atmosphere known as the ionosphere, where the atmosphere is thin enough that the sun's X-rays and UV rays can reach it, but thick enough that there are still enough molecules to absorb those rays. The profile of the ionosphere is highly variable, showing minute-to-minute changes, seasonal changes, and year-to-year changes. The Reverend Joseph L. Yannuzzi points out in his book Antichrist and the End Times, put simply, the apparatus for HARP is a reversal of a radio telescope. Antennae send out signals instead of receiving, and HARP is the test run whose purpose is to emit an ultra-high frequency radio wave that lifts areas of the ionosphere by focusing a beam that discharges heat in a given area. The electromagnetic waves may then bounce back to Earth and penetrate every object of the planet, living and non-living. By this means, it is able to locate and possibly influence all creatures great and small. The extra-low frequency, or ELF antennae, may already be used to create a global shield of heat, hotspots, which is required in the control of local weather. The author adds, HARP media publicity informs the working citizen that the HARP program mainly is an academic project with the goal of changing the ionosphere to improve communications. It argues that it is a good idea to all who believe in sound national defense and to those concerned about cost-cutting. Arco Power Technologies Incorporated, a subsidiary of Atlantic Richfield Company and one of the world's biggest oil companies, built the HARP facility. Arco sold this subsidiary the patents and the second phase construction contract to E-Systems in June 1994. E-Systems, one of the biggest intelligence contractors in the world, assists the CIA in defense intelligence matters and other projects. HARP uses 72-foot-tall ELF antennae, 360 of which are spread out over 4 acres and enclosed with barbed wire fencing. Weather modification is not a figment of the overactive imaginations of conspiracy theorists.